We're an academic journal that's dedicated towards bringing a radical analysis of political economy within African countries. My name is Laura Mann, and I'm going to be the chair for this event. I imagine most people in the audience have a good sense of Sudan, but in case you don't and you're new to being interested in Sudan, about a year ago, a coalition of social forces occupied major cities within Sudan and overthrew the 30-year regime of Omar al-Bashir. And since that year, has been under a transitional government composed of half civilian members and half military members. So in the event today, we're going to be talking about what has happened over the course of the last year in terms of the political transition, and also how the global economic and health crisis is putting pressure on the political transition. So I'm delighted to have a panel of four. So first of all, we have Magdi El-Ghazouli, who is a researcher and a fellow of the Rift Valley Institute, who writes regularly on Sudanese affairs on his blog, Still Sudan. Then we have Salma Abdallah, who's a political scientist whose research focuses on the relationship between religion, politics, and violence. But her PhD was about social policy and Zakat, so I'm going to be asking her to talk a little bit about social policy in the context of the transition. Third up, we have Zuhair Bashar, who is a freelance researcher and consultant with extensive experience in conflict resolution and reconciliation at the grassroots level and regional initiatives. And finally, we have Khalud Khair, who's a British Sudanese political commentator and managing partner of Insight Strategy Partners, which is a think and do tank based in Khartoum. And through this, she's been working state and nation building throughout the transition period. So our fourth and final speaker is Khalud Khair. And I asked her if she could speak about how the current crisis might be shaping the balance of power between the civilian and military sides of the government. Magdi, do you want to start us with that question, and then we can come up to any other people who want to comment about the revenue base, and as well as Mohammed's comments about benevolent capitalism?
Yeah, I think, but I can't answer all these questions. I mean, because I don't know the answers to all these questions, but I'll give it a shot, at least two on the little information I have. The first about the social cash transfer program that the government is proposing. As far as I understand, the government has, this program is off budget. The government has no finance for it right now. It is hoping that it will get generous donations from the Berlin conference, which is either tomorrow or today, I'm not sure, but it's a Zoom conference just like this one, so it shouldn't be too expensive. And it's hoped that the foreign donors or large or generous donors will fund this program. Now, you asked a very good question about how is this program supposed to work in terms of social service provision and the cross-subsidization of these services, or whether the government is subsidizing what sort of policy this program is part of. And the program is part of a policy that includes removal of fuel subsidies, the abolition of fuel subsidy completely, which the government has started pushing through by creating a two-tier system of fuel sales, whereby you can purchase fuel at a subsidized price if you wait long enough, or if you're at the right place at the right time, or if you know the right people. Otherwise, you'd have to buy at a commercial price. And most of the time you end up buying at a black market rate, because most of this fuel ends up smuggled outside these petrol stations into purchasing points around the capital and beyond, because it's becoming a very, very lucrative commodity and you can make a lot of money out of it, including the subsidized variety, which is then not sold. I mean, it's not that difficult to pay the right bribes and get all this moving. Well, there's a large black market space open for these commodities, for fuel. So the government wants to lift the fuel subsidy altogether, and part of the buffering mechanism that it's offering is the cash transfer regime, which is supposed to go on for around a year. Not all people will enter the same time point, so it might extend to 18 months, depending on when you entered. In any case, it's a payment of 12 months. Now, this 12 months payment is supposed to be a cushion against the repercussions of the lift of fuel subsidies. The government has officially said it will not lift wheat subsidies and it will not lift subsidy on medicines. In fact, it has already lifted the subsidy on medicine, and the subsidy on wheat is questionable by the fact that you are also offered a two-tier price system, subsidized variety that you need to wait in long queues for and wake up very, very early to get, and a commercial variety that you can afford if your income is dollarized. However, if your income is based on the local currency, you might not be able to, to bring up enough cash to buy this version of bread. Now, the medicine subsidy is a completely difficult issue right now, because there's severe shortage of medicines in Khartoum, and anybody who has relatives and who is concerned with their health will know that they are calling him and asking to send over medicine, especially those like myself who live abroad. It's a continuous request from people at home, and the problem is that there is no foreign currency available for the purchase of medicines. Why the foreign currency is not available? Because the government has lifted a clause from the Bashir era that more or less forced exporters to determine 10% of their income to a particular account with the bank, 10% of their dollar income from exports to a particular account of the Bank of Sudan that is determined for the purchase of imported medicines. This clause has been abolished, which means there is no particular, from the import income, there's no apportioned segment dedicated to the import of medicine, and the companies have to get their foreign currency from the black market, which the government does not want them to do, because if they start doing that, the prices of medicines will rise, will multiply several times, and then politically the cost of this is too high. So they, between these two positions, they've neither managed to fall on one position or the other, and the result is a severe deficit in medicines in Khartoum. People would be happier if they at least got them for high price, but if they don't get them at all, it's a bit ridiculous. Now, how does this relate to the policy on gold? That the government is withdrawing the Bank of Sudan from the gold market does not mean that government agency, government personnel, government people of power are withdrawing from the gold market. This formula is exactly the most suitable formula for the man who heads the Economic Rescue Committee, which interestingly is not headed by the Prime Minister, but by the Deputy Leader of the Sovereignty Council, the RSF militiaman, and big businessman, to be honest. He's a very big businessman and one of the most important gold exporters in Sudan. Now, with this decision that the Bank of Sudan is pulling out of the market, all his trade became legal overnight, because the requirement for smuggling becomes unnecessary, and the government will rely on his companies to dedicate a portion of their dollar income to the import of fuel and wheat. And that's why they've made an arrangement with the private sector, including some of his companies, to dedicate some of their import income to a particular account. And they gave it a fancy name for the import of strategic commodities, meaning wheat and fuel. Now, this is a gentleman's agreement. The government has no force to, has no strong hand to force the head of the RSF to dedicate this or that amount of money into whatever he wants to do. Of course, if he acquires a monopoly over the fuel and wheat market, he will make a lot of money. And I think that's sort of the price for removing the Bank of Sudan out of the market, out of the gold market. This does not necessarily mean that the government is going to make money in itself, but it will mean that some very important businessmen, among them the head of the RSF, are going to make a lot of money. Does that answer your question, Laura?
Yes, more or less. Is there anybody else that wants to jump in and answer any of these questions before? I'd like to move on to more questions because there's a lot of questions, but I want to give an opportunity.
Yeah, I think Magdi have said it all. I just wanted to add a small part for your question, Laura, because I think it's really very interesting question is to know how easy will it be to cross subsidies across, for example, wealthier and poorer parts of the country to build solidarity and public goods. I think one step that has been taken by the government is also to dismantle this old structures of power, or the structure of power of the old regime, and also lead anti-corruption initiatives. So one of the results of this committee has been dissolved the National Congress Party, the previous ruling party, and also they dissolved all the party interfaces and affiliated organizations, and also confiscate the party property and assets in favor of the government. Of course, not everyone has felt the impact of this confiscation of properties yet, but it has a lot of moral or psychological impact for the people to see at least that the previous ruling party is not any longer in control of its economic fortunes.
Thank you very much for that, Salma. I want to move on because there are lots of other questions in the chat box. And I wanted to start with a question from Thomas Dale, because it kind of builds a little bit on some of the things we've been talking about sort of given that so many of the kind of contingencies of COVID are empowering the military side of the civilian government. He wanted to ask about like what can be done to kind of counteract that from external actors. So Thomas, do you want to, I don't know if I've summarized your point, but do you want to add anything to that? Thomas? If you could unmute yourself. Thomas Dale? I don't know, maybe he's partly moved off, or maybe he's in the next room with an animal or a baby. So I'm gonna move to Abdul Rahman had a question about what are the possibilities of success. I don't know if you want to say more than that. Abdul Rahman?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
My question is, it's true that there are many challenges transition and since our independence, but what are the possibilities of success today? Because this revolution, in spite of all observers before, they had never expected that the Sudanese could make such a change. People have created, as Mighty has told us, these revolutionary committees. Also, the revolution had not started in Khartoum, the capital, as usual. It came from the rural areas or the rural towns, in fact, from Damajin, Sinnar, Atbara, and then at last came to Khartoum. As well, people in Khartoum managed to make a collision of illegal professional organizations. They managed to form political organizations or political union between parties and civil groups. So there is hope that not that the same process, the Sudanese revolution is not an event. It is a process that, and it is a protracted events that started in 1989 with the beginning of this Islamic dictatorship. And there are the marginal areas which are starting their armed struggle. And people many times have challenged Tshisekedi. So I believe that there is hope that the civilian transition could be achieved. And in spite of the military putting obstacles in the road, they have no constituency of Sudanese to support them, except the old regime, which all people have rejected. So why don't we think about what are the possibilities of success today, and what have been done is very great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So last question I'm going to take in this round, and I know that there are questions about June 30th protests, and I'm going to come to those. But I wanted to go to Leo, who had a question as well about kind of ideology and consciousness raising. Leo?
Yes. It's a question really that I asked principally on the forum. And I think it's kind of opened up. I mean, to start with, that I was one of the observers from afar of the Sudanese revolution. And it was absolutely astonishing, even witnessing that revolution from principally from London and from the UK. And also perhaps the advantage of seeing it at this distance is that I was able to see it in a regional and international context, that it was part of a movement, you know, as the last speakers indicated, that goes back a long way in Sudan, but also in terms of political and social struggle around the world, of which we're seeing the emergence of an extraordinary movement in around the world centered on Black Lives Matter. So it was around the question of that international context, which I think is so often ignored, partly because it's not easily answered, but the inspiration that many of us received seeing those protests, those committees organizing, frequently the most oppressed and marginalized groups taking a lead in those struggles. And of course, the viral footage of that astonishing demonstration in Khartoum led by a militant woman, which of course was an extraordinary sight. So my question, which many of you will have already read, is what extent, when Magdi talks about the failure and the influence of the failure of the Egyptian revolution on the struggles taking place in Sudan, how have other movements in that period that we're still in of revolutionary struggle and struggle from below, as Haiku has mentioned, not simply as a pressure to work on liberal democratic reform, so that these committees do not serve simply the purpose of pressure groups to power a version of liberal democracy, but as a potential force in themselves. So I was just wondering what the impact of other revolutionary movements and struggles, particularly in Algeria last year, have had on the popular consciousness and politics in Sudan. And then another related question, what forms of alternative news have been created within the revolutionary struggle in Sudan, particularly within the committees? Are there newspapers or news sheets that are produced? And this for me is key because it starts to ask the question about how that consciousness raising of all struggles and movements has begun to build up during this populist struggle in Sudan, has taken shape and laid down roots, and to what extent that's being tackled by radical forces on the ground. So that's my very long-winded question. Sorry for that, Laura.
Okay, so I'm going to start with Khaloud and then Zuhair, because we haven't heard from them last round. So of those three questions, Khalid, do you want to go first, perhaps maybe on the external environment a little bit? Khalid?
Yes, there are certainly very broad questions. and, you know, I'm glad to see that there's so much kind of, there's so much interest in kind of the more granular details of this revolution, that it's not just the headlines that are being, you know, felt around the world. What I would say is that, not to take too much time, but, you know, the context that we're living in right now, globally, is one where, you know, activism and a new, I don't want to use, you know, kind of liberal democratic norms. I feel they're quite calcified in a different time. But I think there are these reimaginings of these, you know, progressive, shall we say, ideas that are more contextualized to different contexts. So, for example, you know, in previous decades, we may have seen something, you know, originate in one context and then being taken wholesale to somewhere else. I think what we're seeing now, you know, Leo mentioned the Black Lives Matter protests, but what we're seeing now, even with Black Lives Matter, is that the internal domestic issues are being kind of brought to bear on protests that kind of tap into the Black Lives Matter kind of headline, if you will. And that's the same that happened with the protests here in Sudan. You know, yes, there was certainly some kind of learning, if you will, from regional protests in Algeria, in Libya, in Egypt. But there is also a history in Sudan of political activism that has been, you know, part of Sudanese political and social life for a very long time. And I think that was something that was also tapped into. What we saw a lot of during the protests, during the revolution, was iconography and, you know, chants and singing that was evoking the previous revolutions, and people saying this is our, you know, our time to prove that we are just as, you know, able to unseat these people that are oppressing us as people who came before us. What I think is happening is that there is strength in number, because you're not, you don't feel like you're in a, you know, in a vacuum, as it were, that there are others supporting what you're doing. I think the possibility of success, which the gentleman mentioned, it's, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer. That it's something I think that's quite dynamic. It changes almost every day. There are days that I wake up and think we're on the right track and we just need a few you know, tweaks. And there are days when I think it's hopeless. And that often is dependent on how far away decisions that are being made feel, I suppose, from the source of this government's power, which is the street. But just to speak briefly on external aspects, as you asked, Laura, you know, COVID has changed some of the external relationships, if you will, and if not necessarily, you know, changed them entirely, but certainly in some ways, you know, we're seeing countries want have some kind of maybe more insular, taking a more insular stance, or because of the global depression, becoming a bit more, should we say, careful about how much money they pledge, etc. You know, we've got the Friends of Sudan meeting, which is happening on the 25th. The government has requested $1.5 billion, and it's likely to get half at best. But the pandemic is being used in some ways to do some strategic politicking as well. You know, we've seen China suspend repayments to loans from African countries for this year, 2020. And on the flip side, we've also seen that punitive SST designation, you know, state-sponsored terrorism designation, hasn't been suspended, which is blocking Sudan from getting access to $700 million from a World Bank IMF fund. And so politics hasn't been suspended just because of COVID. If anything, we're feeling that more acutely. You know, and speaking of the IMF, you know, the revolution last year was in part a rejection of IMF and World Bank policy related to lifting of subsidies. What this government needs to demonstrate now is greater awareness of that in its economic planning, which is still being done in concert with the World Bank and the IMF. So I'm not sure that it's taking full stock of what Sudan has as a country and is able to plan long, you know, longer term. Sudan is not a poor country. It has just been consistently poorly managed. And I think the more that we reconcile ourselves to that as a country and as you know, senior leadership, the more we'll be able to make better choices related to external policy or external relations. We've just seen that the UAE has reasserted its commitment to support. We've seen Qatar, which was initially this week with relish, after this week's delivery through Turkish Airlines of 700 tons of food, you're trying to eke out a foothold once more. You know, this relationship with regional Muslim Brotherhood-led countries needs to be carefully managed. I think, don't think Sudan is in a position to refuse any kind of relations, but we do need to think more consciously about how we manage those relationships. And ironically, the Bashir government's lack of comprehensive foreign policy had allowed it to somewhat deftly manage regional politics through an ad hoc approach. The downside of this, of course, is that they were unable to make longer-term financial and strategic gains from this seeming neutrality in regional affairs. And that's something that this government needs to contend with very quickly because of the tensions between Egypt and Ethiopia that it currently finds itself mired in. You know, Sudan is still remains a geopolitically important and resource-rich country, and the revolution has diminished the previous trade-off of having to deal with a murderous regime. I see Sudan somewhat as debutante at the ball that all the suitors want. But again, this unique position is marred by what looks very much like indecision and a country not taking full stock of its long-term options. The other thing is that, you know, we're talking about liberalization of markets, etc., and we're seeing that the government currently is selling off a lot of state-owned companies. But my worry is then, you know, who is in a position to snap those countries up? And it's people who, it's the mercantile class who, if not benefited, certainly has not been worse for the wear over the past 30 years. So, you know, even if these state-owned companies are said to be liquidated to release funds, who will be snapping them up? But those same mercantile classes that have done quite well, if you will, out of the Bashir regime, and then can invite West, not necessarily Western, but certainly regional countries to invest. And we will still have a repetition of the same economic formula that got us to the revolution. You know, IMF and World Bank led policies, plus this kind of wholesale sale of Sudanese or state-owned enterprises.
Okay, thank you, Zuha. I'm going to ask you to take the next question from Sarah Abdul-Ghalil, because I really want to squeeze her question in, because she's had her hand up from the very beginning. So Sarah, do you want to unmute your microphone and ask your question?
Yes, thank you very much. My question is very basic. It's about the balance within the political system. So the revolution, everybody contributed to this. And we have the unique experience of the resistance committee. And we had the return of the unions to some extent back into the fight for democratic change. But following the revolution, there is no balance between the civil societies, the unions, the community, and the political parties. We are back to the same where the leaders are the political parties. They feel they will determine our future, they will shape our future, and we don't have the balance between all of the groups, and therefore this will affect the transition. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that, Sarah. And I'm going to just throw two other questions from people, but I'm not going to ask them to ask them themselves because we don't have time. But both Amira Mohammed and Mohammed Hashim asked about the 30th of June and sort of what are the objectives of that. I see that there are other questions in the chat, but I don't want us to go too over time. So I think we'll have to ask people to send emails if they want to ask things of this panelists. But just to close us out, Zuhair, can you start us on this final round of questions? So the question from Sarah and then the questions about the 30th of June. Thank you. Zuhair? Zuhair, can you please unmute your microphone?
Yeah, thank you very much, Laura. And thank you for the question from Sarah and Abdurrahman and Leo. Do you want me to go for the last question? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you can go for the last question, but if you have things about the others as well.
Okay. I think the problem with the Sudanese Professional Association is that this organization or entity have been influenced by the political parties in Sudan, and we can see how the political parties are different and coming into conflict with regard to their own programs, starting from left up to further right. And at the beginning of the revolution in Sudan, the objective was very clear. It's just toss good bus to topple the regime. And that phrase or that objective, everyone was agreed to, no question about it. And after the regime was toppled down, then people start to look for maybe personal interest and party interest. That is why the Sudanese Professional Association is now struggling, now have a problem. And I just jump into the question raised by Abdurrahman. Thank you for that. The possibility of success. I think the possibility of success of this revolution in Sudan lies to a large extent in the hands of resistance communities. This is the only guarantor for this revolution. And everyone in Sudan, or someone is a closer observer, can see these committees are still very strong, are still working, and they are still putting their objectives over there, and they are looking to it and observing every single step taken by the government. And that is why now there is a call for administration on the 30th of June. This administration is meant to tell the transitional government, especially the civilian part of it, that you are not doing your job. The revolution is not going on the right direction to achieve its goals. No peace has been achieved, although there was a limit of target for the peace. It was 6 months, and now we passed that to 10 months. And there is another issue of economic crisis is still the same as before, if not more, the situation is more deteriorated than before, let alone the unfinished job of the transitional institutions. Up to now, we don't have a legislative assembly, and this is supposed to be established only 3 months, within 3 months after the establishment of the government. Now we pass almost 10 months and the legislative is not in place. So there is a lot and a lot. That is why the resistance committees are planning to come out to street and to say enough is enough. And I think the guarantor for this revolution is this resistance committees and the political parties and the trade unions are so much influenced by the superstructure leader, the superstructure of their leadership, and they lost touch with the people at the grassroots level. I go again and again and say the only guarantor is the resistance committees. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. I just want to give the other three speakers just 2 minutes each. We'll go slightly over just to respond to anything interesting that came out of the discussion that you feel that you want to have a voice in. So Salma, do you want to go first?
Yes, I would like to address the question, interesting question by Sarah about the imbalance of power between civil society organization and other components of the political scene. I think one of the dangerous, I mean, first of all, we recognize the role of the civil society in achieving this revolution, in toppling the regime. But one particular change that occurred in the last since this government assumed power is that many leaders of the civil society have been incorporated with the government, within the government, or they have also been appointed in different positions as ministers or in various political positions. And this is I look at it as alarming also. Situation for this, especially for the civil society. It's kind of a call or invitation that civil society need to stay as civil society and continue to observe the government and also to support the transitional period and also to support the transition in Sudan. So one of the dangerous steps is to try to incorporate all the these leaders of the civil society organizations or activists within the government, I think, will contribute to further imbalance in the power within these different angles.
Okay, thank you, Salma. Magdi, I'm going to come to you next. Do you have any final thoughts? Oh, you have to unmute your microphone.
I just can't learn, can I? I wanted to answer that question about trade unions. I think it's an important question. One place of absence, it's an assumed place of absence, is organized labor. And it's assumed because we don't know enough about organized labor, but I've counted in its new format. I mean, whenever organized labor comes into discussion, people refer back to events that took place in Sudan 60 years ago in Adbara. But it's very hard for them to imagine how industrial production in today's Sudan works, because very few people have done that effort and went to these places and sort of saw how these systems of expropriation function today. But since the beginning of December 18, I've counted at least 18 or 19 instances of industrial action, not coming from the professional associations, but coming from the workers' movement. It's industrial action in the sense that these are in the terminology of the tradition I come from, proletarians in the strict sense of the word. They're not white collar workers, they're blue collar workers. And however, the sizes of these industrial enterprises are large or small, and these struggles are not connected, and most of them are wildcat strikes. So they're not led by a trade union in the formal sense. The trade unions, the labor trade unions, have not recovered. And one reason behind that delay in recovery is probably people are still searching for the right formula to organize across sectors, especially when an industrial plant does not employ beyond 20 persons. And that's most of these industrial production sites, with the exception maybe of the wheat mills, which have large employment capacity, and the industrial plant in Jazeera that makes cars, and of course the oil sector. And in these sectors, there were strikes in the wheat granaries and the wheat plants. There were strikes in the cement sector and Adbara, and there were strikes in the service sector, especially in Khartoum and others. But in all of these instances, I am afraid to say the transitional government, if that word makes any sense, chose to stand on the wrong side from where I think you should supposedly stand. They stood on the side of capital as opposed to the side of labor, and they approved the dismissal of working men in Adbara and the dismissal of working men in Khartoum who were part of the sanitation and the cleaning company. And they did not step in usefully in that discussion. I think their influence was rather counterproductive. So the point about organized labor is a strong one, is a valid one. And I think we've seen a resurgence of some of these forms of strike and action, but they haven't really come up yet with a formula for organization. If the trade union movement in the UK can help, it can tell us something about how to organize across sectors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Magdi. And finally, to Khalud, if you have any final thoughts, you get the last word. Khalud?
Thank you very much, Laura. I think it's been a very enriching discussion, so thank you to everyone. I think one thing that I would like people to take away from this is that, you know, while we've been quite critical, and I think that's very important, that we do have a chance at this moment to galvanize the kind of support on the ground, internationally, across the diaspora, that can actually give this thing a fighting chance. And I think just kind of the different ideas that are coming out, it's quite clear that people are thinking very broadly across very many political and economic issues. And I don't think that previous transitions in Sudan have benefited from this level of ground-based support, right? Both within the country and also outside of it. I think what we need to do is keep our eye on, you know, the challenges as they arise and keep up this pressure. You know, as we've all intimated, the revolution is not over. Just because we have this transitional government doesn't mean we can kind of hand over, if you will, our power. And I think we do.
Okay, I think, Khalud, you have frozen on my end.
We do need to keep up the pressure on everyone, including ourselves, broad as consensus building support given. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
And just to go back to Sarah's point about civil society, I think we need to also reimagine what civil society is. I think there is this calcification of civil society, these national NGOs that have become too embedded perhaps in the politics of the former regime, that they can't properly respond to the current challenges. I think looking, as Mehdi said, you know, the resistance committees are Sudan's gift to the world, this new kind of way of using, it's kind of new politics, but using older entrenched social policies, such as Nafir, you know, the social mobilization, to make more local issues political. And I think people are finding that out more and more. What applies in our way, what gives us prosperity, that is entirety-led rather than capture, etc. So that's just kind of my final thought on this thing.
Okay, so thank you very much for that. I just want to thank everybody who has been a part of this discussion, everybody who has attended the chat, and I also want to thank the four speakers. I'm going to propose that we have a round of applause before we say goodbye, because I hate the kind of just closing down of Zoom seminars. But before we do that, I just want to highlight that we're going to be having another seminar probably on the 15th of July that's going to be talking about kind of digital surveillance and how it's changing what we know about society and the way in which people conceptualize a society, whether society is becoming more segmented or whether this kind of added surveillance is making new kinds of groups more visible. Maybe it's changing the way we think about vulnerability. So we're going to have three speakers probably on the 15th of July, and we'll have details on our website. But just finally, I would like everybody to unmute their microphones, and I just want to give a round of applause to our four speakers and to all of the people who asked questions. And I apologize if we didn't get to your question. I know that I don't want anybody to feel sad that we didn't get to your question. So please feel free to email any of the people who spoke today with your question. But let's just have a round of applause and thank everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.
Bye, Liz.
Bye, Liz.
Bye. Well done. Well done. Thank you. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello to some people.
Yes, hello and
goodbye.
Hello, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
See, people don't want to leave. It's always a sign of a good meeting where people are slow to leave.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
How are you?
Thanks, Laura.
Good.
How are you, Leo?
Very good. Is that Femi?
That's right.
Hi, comrade. Good to hear from you.
Femi's in a taxi.
It's a pleasure.
Femi. We've emailed lots of times. Hi there.
How are you? Long time.
Hi, Femi.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you, Femi.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Great that you could come to the meeting, Femi.
Thanks.
Thanks, Salma. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mama.